Welcome to episode 22 of the Book Wars Pod. My name is Kate, and I'm here with Chris and Kristen, and today we are finishing up, well, not super finishing up, we're finishing up reading the book, what are we reading?
Battlefront 2, Infernal Squad, chapters 20 to the end.
Yes, I can't talk today.
Does nobody read the outline?
No, listen, okay, guys, so as some of you may know, I have been working on getting a Star Wars-related tattoo, and so I just finished up the color work today, except for those of you who don't really know anything about tattoos, you have to do the outline first, and then you can color it in, but when you're coloring it in, you're basically shading the whole thing, so it's not just... You know, it's just basically they're scraping a whole bunch of needles across your body to do the shading. It's like literally coloring in a coloring book. And so I'm kind of in a lot of pain and a little woozy and I don't know what's happening. So that was a great idea for me to introduce the pod. Anyway, what are people drinking? Kristen?
I am drinking a green and orange LaCroix called Mango. No alcohol right now because I have to pack for DC. Because I'm coming. I leave tomorrow morning, which is not the day that this is being released. By the time this is released, I will be back in Portland. But I'm...
Yes, you will.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'll be not here in DC anymore.
No, you'll be way back. But it's exciting, because we're finally going to be able to do an episode all in the same place, and then maybe Keeks won't be clipping like crazy.
Lord willing. What are you drinking, Kate?
I am... drinking, I don't know how to say this.
I don't know.
Okay. it's a manque or something? I don't know how to say things, so somebody punched me in the face if I said it wrong. So it's Malbec, and I'm just basically going bottle to the face on this because I'm in a lot of pain and I don't care.
So this should be another quality episode.
Please drink water also because you're dehydrated.
I have water. I've been drinking water.
I'm drinking juice because I had a work retreat this weekend, and now my body is reaping the punishment of doing a lot of drinking in close proximity with a lot of people and not sleeping enough.
Juice.
Yeah. We're a lively bunch today.
Hey, I'm lively. I'm doing great. I am super high on adrenaline still.
Yeah, I was going to say the pain's worn off and the adrenaline's kicked in.
So yeah, exactly.
You're going to be carrying us today.
I know. That's not good, man. Alright. Anyway.
Listeners, this is how much we love you. We're recording even under these circumstances.
I know. I literally have a giant wound in my leg. Alright, so, shall we dive in?
Yeah.
In case you didn't get that, because I am word salad today, we are finishing our reading, at least, of Inferno Squad by Christy Golden. Next episode will be the wrap-up, which we're recording when Keeks is in town. Yay! But before we do that, we are talking more about the evilness of the Empire, but also the fact that the Dreamers aren't such great people themselves.
Yeah, that's like the big thing that you get from Inferno Squad, is that everyone sucks, basically. Because, when back in the Clone Wars, you had heroes on both sides.
Oh my god. Because please stop.
But Kate, did you know there's heroes on both sides?
You're just saying that because Lux is in this book.
Heroes on both sides. Oh, wow. God, unintentionally nailed it.
Nailed it! Alright.
But no, like, in all seriousness, Clone Wars in that era is very much about this concept of, like, there's two sides in here, and while, like, the Sith are manipulating everything, both of them have actual good people on them. And this one just shows us that everyone is evil. Like, basically... the Rebellion has some awful people in it. Obviously, they're not associated with the Alliance, but the Rebellion writ large has some awful people in it, in the Dreamers, but obviously we know terrible things about the Empire.
We are in the heart of darkness.
Lux is the mentor, guys.
Yay! You got
sure
it.
Sure is, Kristen.
That's a point. That was something. Where does he show up for the first time?
He shows up for the first time in Clone Wars, and I can't remember what season it is. But basically, he's the son of a senator who's, are they neutral or are they separatists?
They're neutral.
Okay.
No, they're not. They're separatists.
Yeah, so he's the son of a separatist senator, okay, no offense, but I hated Lux in the Clone Wars, and, like, you can at me about that if you want. So I literally don't remember the context of this first episode that he was in. But basically, he does show up in a few arcs. He shows up in that one where, basically trying to put a human face on the Separatist cause. And he shows up later when we get introduced to Death Watch on Mandalore. And then he shows up even later in the Onderon arc, which we have been talking about a whole lot, which is obviously where he knows Saw and Steel from.
He's very thirsty for Ahsoka.
He's always thirsty for everybody.
Okay, fair.
God.
I can talk about why it's ironic that he's the mentor here, because the context of when we first meet Lux is that his mother is assassinated for trying to negotiate a diplomatic end to the Clone War.
Twisty.
So his mother was, like, the leading pacifist, and she was a separatist, but actually hated the war and was, like, really good friends with Padme, who was also a leading pacifist and very much against the war. And then she was, Senator Bonteri was assassinated, and then her son decided to join Death Watch, the violent extremist group, and then...
To get revenge,
and then saws rebels on Onderon to fight in the Clone War, but against the separatists. To get revenge.
Because reasons. Oh, Lux.
Now he's with the Dreamers, who are, like, awful.
Before that, he says he was with the Empire.
Before that, he says he was with the Empire, which we know nothing
basically,
about.
Basically, Lux, get your shit together.
He's a kind of messy trash baby.
He is. I hate him so much. Anyway.
We alluded to that last episode, so I wanted to follow that up. We find out in, like, the last couple chapters or something, but obviously Kate and Chris knew, and I'm sure I knew somewhere in my brain I had that information.
Yeah, well, if you want to know the breadcrumb trail that led Chris and me to figuring out that it was Lux, just tweet at me, because I don't want to explain it
listen next episode, because we're going to talk about it next episode.
We'll plug all this clone stuff in the description as we do, in case you want to go back and torture yourself and hate Lux with us. But yeah, I mean, I think, okay, question first, because I never remember anything. How many plans did Lux's goddaughter give him? Stepdaughter?
11?
Stepdaughter, sorry.
No, it's good. I mean, he calls her straight up his daughter, because that's apparently how close they were. But she gave him 11, I believe, plans in total, and they only went through with 4?
Okay, so there was, like, they left a lot of stuff on the table, yeah?
Sure.
4, and one of them was the aborted factory bombing where Sidori died.
Abort. Oh, that's so sad.
Was it sad, though? Because, like, his failure meant that, like, hundreds of children didn't die.
But he was precious. Well, anyway, well, okay,
it's also
so
crazy, though. Like, this kind of, like, goes into,
so let's,
like,
talk about, yeah.
Like, how evil everybody is, because, like, obviously, like, the Empire is evil. We know that, and we actually get a really good view of that through Donna's eyes. The Twi'lek second-in-command.
Right.
I guess, at least before Gideon gets there.
Right, Staven's second-in-command.
Staven's second-in-command of the Dreamers. And she is immediately bonds with Sane, because Sane is pretending to be a slave.
Right. And, like, right off the bat when we meet her, she alludes to the fact that the person who owned her, which is, what a horrible phrase, was really horrible, and she was just saying, she alludes to the horrible, horrible abuse she suffered while she was a slave, because she says, Twi'leks are hired to be dancers. My master made me do a different kind of dance, and I was just like, oh, God, it's horrible. So, yeah, like,
very bad.
Yeah, right off the bat. She tells us that she was sexually abused and attacked, and it's horrible, and of course we have to sympathize with that, because who deserves that ever? Like, no matter who you are.
Totally.
Yeah, and obviously, like, that's very much a, you know, personal result of her master being horrible, but it's also an institutional result of the Empire being the Empire and supporting and propping up the slave trade.
Totally.
And so, like, you, right off the bat, you get, you get this view of the Empire and how horrible they are.
Mm-hmm.
But you also get a really clear view of how terrible the Dreamers are with Staven's targeting of children. And that's, like, I don't know, it's like kind of like a whole, like, thing. Whenever you have a book about, like, insurgent groups or the good guys, even if they're resorting to bad things, like, the targeting of children is always where the line is drawn, you know, in fiction, often in real life, too. Like, the targeting of innocents and the targeting of children is beyond the pale. And Staven's view of that is they're children of the Empire. They will grow up to be the stormtroopers that will murder people.
Which is exactly what Aiden's dad says about the rebels, no?
Right. That's exactly what he says about Alderaan, that it's, yeah, that it's this nexus of insurgency. And, of course, the entire planet got blown up, so who knows how many women and children died, but he says they weren't children. They were, like, the spawn of our enemies, and they would grow up to be rebels.
Yeah, exactly. And so you have this kind of dueling race to the bottom of neither of them see each other as human, or their offspring as human. And it really, basically the moral here is, stop, like, just because somebody did something bad doesn't mean you have to do something even worse.
Yeah, I think part of the reason that I was so sad about Sidori is because he was one of the only likable characters in the book, in my opinion.
Right, like, he was a cinnamon roll, despite the fact that, I mean, he was 18 and, like, when you're 18, you know what right and wrong is, but
18 with an attitude, you might say.
That's right. 19, kind of snotty, acting real rude. Kate's
going
to leave the podcast. It's fine.
That's great. No, I agree with you, though. I really liked Sidori, despite the fact that, like, and I was sad when he died, despite the fact that he literally went to suicide, bombed 400 fucking kids, which just really goes to show how complex his character is, that he's basically a cinnamon roll. Like I was trying to say, he, at 18, you know what right and wrong is, but it's clear that he's been on the run from the Empire from a very young age because his species, the Cages, they've been targeted very heavily by the Empire. And, you know, at a certain, like, after a while, after you've, like, been living under that and listening to your parents, and your parents have joined these rebel groups, and your parents have joined the Dreamers, no less, you can't help, I think, but be influenced by that kind of rhetoric. And so, he's bad, but I also get it, even though it's bad, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't even second guess it, right?
Right, exactly, which, I was reading that bit, and I was just like, no!
I mean, that's what indoctrination does, though, right?
Right! Yeah.
Like, that's why, I don't know, it's interesting because that's why, like, I actually really liked Sane as a character. She was my favorite character in the book. And that's, like, part of what made her so dangerous, too, right? And, like, the fact that she almost, like, you know, not to talk about it in, like, kind of, like, robot terms, but basically she challenged Sidori's brainwashing for a hot second there. And, like, made him care about her and, like, obviously, it didn't end up being enough to stop him from killing himself, but, like, that is, like, that made her character just so much more fascinating to me, and that, like, the fact that she was, like, you know, this, in a way, almost the most calculating of all of the members of Inferno Squad, and also had the largest emotional effect.
Right. It helped for me, too, that they were, you know, Sane was the youngest on the team, she was 20, and like I said, Sidori was 18, and it's just, like, it's one of the, I'm not so far from being those ages myself that I you know, I can't help but understand, like, where they're coming from, because, like, I think about myself back in college, because that's what kind of ages they are, and it's, like, I was a fucking idiot. I was a kid, you know? So.
Just to backtrack for a minute, do we know any Cages from other stuff? Cage Warriors?
Two in the Kanan comics. They're the ones who went and bombed the temple. Who were helping out with the temple bombing.
Yes, the one that bombed the temple and the one that attacked with Grievous on Megiddo.
Thank you. I knew the answer to that, but for the listeners' benefit, although most of them also probably know because they're big old nerds like us.
They've been good in reading along with us. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. But we don't know a ton about the Cages, but I mean, we know just from the canon comics that apparently the Republic was not good to their world.
And what episode was that?
That would have been our episode about the canon comics, which was episode 19. Three episodes ago, right before we started reading Inferno Squad. So you should go back and re-listen to episode 19.
We don't talk about the Cage Warriors at all.
We don't, but you should listen to it anyway. Anyway, so I was just going to kind of talk about our last bit of cruelty that we really get to see of, like, in this book, is that even at the end when, you know, you've started to, like, kind of take a liking to Inferno Squad and, like, you're feeling really bad about Sane and you're wondering how this is all going to wrap up. And then you have Gideon, who kind of just shows his, like, most startling brutality, where he basically just murders the Dreamers with a smile on his face.
Yeah, that was fucking gross.
Like, and this is, like, Staven, he's become, like, bros with.
Fucking disgusting.
Yeah. Right. I remember, because I recently rewatched the, kind of, the behind-the-scenes trailer for the Battlefront video game, but when they're describing Gideon's character, they're saying that, basically, he's the truest of believers out of all of Inferno Squad. He's the one who, like, you know, rails on them that this is for the Empire, this is about the Empire, like, we have to do this sort of thing, and it really shows here. So Battlefront starts at the Battle of Endor, so this is, like, four years before that, and Gideon's already Gideon, you know? Like, he's that character that they were describing in the trailer for the video game.
Yeah, and we'll, I think, talk a little bit more about some of the characterization next episode in our wrap-up, but I feel like, in a way, he was one of the more well-developed characters in this book, just because I feel like his character was fairly shallow. Like, I feel like the point of his character is that he is, like, he's like that bro, you know, who kind of, like, only has one speed. Like, his speed is he loves the Empire, and he will do whatever it takes to help the Empire, and he doesn't, this is going to sound really mean, and it's kind of intended to be really mean, but he doesn't have a lot of other higher cognitive functioning than that, you know?
I mean, I didn't all but say that, honestly.
Yeah.
At the beginning, so.
Just from, like, a grossly militaristic standpoint, that's why he's on the squad, you know? Like, that's probably part of the reason that he was chosen, is because he, not only is he highly skilled, but he's also brainwashed to the point of killing people and thinking that it's funny.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's also what makes him such a good pilot. He's just got a one-track mind, which, you know, for better or for worse, it makes him real focused, so here we are.
Yeah, definitely. So let's back up to the Cage Warriors a little bit, and Sidori, and kind of talk about, do you have a larger discussion about parenting in Star Wars, and, like, what we've seen from, obviously there's plenty of parenting issues, and the movies, and Rebels, and Clone Wars, but, like, kind of what we've seen from the books, because you have the Cage Warriors and Sidori, and it's a very, and it's a really interesting dynamic, because on the one hand, they are, like, very clearly these loving parents who, on the other hand, are sending their son on suicide bombing missions.
Yeah, it's this weird dichotomy between they're doing that and they're letting him take part in all this, but also neither of them will, like, both go on a mission at the same time anymore, because just in case one of them doesn't come back, like, one of them needs to be there for Sidori, which is, like, the weirdest twist of logic you could probably come up with. Like, how many knots did you have to make out of yourself to be like, yeah, this is like fine and makes sense, I'll take it all together, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. Like, it's kind of unlike anything else that we've ever seen in Star Wars, that kind of militaristic attitude even toward family.
Right, and I don't really have a lot to add to this point, but I just want to say that this is probably one of the rare times in Star Wars where we see somebody actually having two parents instead of just being raised by a single parent or no parents.
Ooh, that's a great point.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and I think, like, that obviously added to the indoctrination of their son, just because he was raised in that, right? But by both of his, you know, as a united front, I suppose. But Also, what I kind of can't get over is that there are so few dreamers left that I've just found myself so confused that they could kind of like delude themselves into thinking that this was the right way to do things, especially when we know that there were also like devil cells. But I know that that's like a bigger question of Saw and the way that he did things, and I know we'll probably touch on that in the wrap up, but I think it's probably just because like I have a soft heart.
I mean, to be fair, I think it's a pretty slippery slope from sending an 18-year-old on suicide bombing missions to killing 400 school kids, so.
Yeah, true. And I don't know, one thing I want to know more about, which, like, seems like we're gonna at some point, I don't know when, but, like, we're not done with Lux, very clearly. And I want to know more about, like, why he didn't just join the rebellion. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like he could have pretty easily been a leading figure in the rebellion, like, had he, you know, come into the fold after Saw's death.
That's a fair point, but at the same time, from what we know of him in Clone Wars, he's a very kind of proper and almost old-fashioned kind of dude, even when he's a kid, and I feel like there's some weird sense of honor in him that because he was allied with Saw, he needed to join up with Saw's group, and of course he was in love with Steela. And besides the fact, you know, he, like you were saying when you were explaining his character earlier, Chris, he spent an awful lot of time in Clone Wars running around trying to exact revenge, so who knows, honestly.
Yeah, I was gonna say, he's also, like, pretty extreme in the way that he goes about things, right? He's really ride or die. Joins fucking Death Watch instead of any other group, right? And he joins Saw's Rebels instead of any other group of Rebels, right? Or I guess not really Rebels at that time, but you know what I mean, the Republic. Yeah.
His mom was all about finding a diplomatic solution to this stuff, and he goes back to Onra, and he's like, nope, doesn't work, yeah. My mom died, let's fuck shit up.
It's like there's some PTSD happening there.
So.
Almost.
Almost, like, where have we seen that before in Star Wars, besides everywhere?
I know, right? And also, like, his relationship with his unnamed stepdaughter is...
Yeah, we don't know her, right? We don't know who that is.
I don't know, like, it's...
Are we supposed to? I assume not.
I don't think so.
No.
Okay, cool.
As far as I know, making
sure. No, I don't think it's a character. It certainly was not alluded to as a character that we know. If it is, it's not a connection that we've been told to make yet. But yeah, it's like, they're definitely going to tell us more about Lux at some point, because there's just so many unanswered questions about him and what's going on in his head. Because
she's
like,
sure not dead either, so.
She's clearly not dead. She's clearly an Imperial, and, like, Lux, who is, you know, for all his faults and his support of the Dreamers, is, like, so against Staven's brutality and bloodthirstiness, but at the same time is willing to use his own daughter, or his stepdaughter, who he feels, who he loves as a biological daughter, as a pawn in that, what, frankly, in the grand scheme of things, is a pretty petty revenge game. Like, even if they'd accomplished, like, bombing all 11 of those places, like, what would, I don't know, it's, something just was not fully formed about that plan in a way that we also, like, don't really see from, like, leading figures in Star Wars.
I don't want to, like, psychoanalyze Lux, except I'm about to, but it's just...
Well, good, but it's okay, because you prefaced it with, I don't want to do it, but, so that'll...
Yeah, I know,
okay.
Like, so, that makes it totally fine. I just want to say that I think it's interesting that one of the interesting things about Lux is that he's shaped by all the women in his life. There are not really any dudes in his life. Like, he was his, I think his dad died in the Clone Wars or something. And, you know, by the time we meet him, it's only his mom that's in the picture. And of course, then we get his relationship with Ahsoka. We get his relationship with Steela. And then when we move to Rebel Rising, we get his relationship with Maya, his goddaughter. And now we have his relationship with his stepdaughter. And he's never really done right by any of them, has he?
No, and he kind of makes reference to it too, where he's like, I've, like, had the privilege of knowing a great many incredible women, and, like, I don't remember his exact wording, but he's basically like, and I screwed it all up.
I wanted to dick kick him at that point. I hate Lux so much. Sorry. If anyone out there is a Lux fan, I'm sorry, but I'm also, like, not sorry.
Yeah, I really did not. I feel like he was supposed to be a sympathetic character in this, and I just really... Between what we know about him from Clone Wars and his depiction in this book, he just seems very woe-is-me about everything, and, like, everything happens to him.
Who the fuck are you, Anakin?
I
went there.
What if Lux is Rey's dad?
Lux is not Rey's dad.
Dud. Just to be clear, because this fandom is extra as hell, that was a joke.
Our listeners are not extra as hell. So far.
Since when?
Okay, they're not, like... No, they're like, the intelligent
they're listening, kind of... They're listening to this garbage fire that clearly makes them extra.
Okay, yeah, but they're, like... They're such lovely, smart people. I don't know. I love talking to you guys.
I was going to say, that was fucked up. You know what else is fucked up? Aiden's relationship with her parents.
Oh my god, you need to stop.
Hashtag
yo,
I'm drinking more.
That was crazy that Aiden's dad ended up telling Aiden's mom, or lied to Aiden and made it seem like he told Aiden's mom. What do you guys think?
Oh my god, I didn't even think that he might have lied. Fuck me!
He loves lying.
Whoa.
I wish y'all could see my face right now because I'm just, like, silently screaming. What a
hey,
great point.
If the world has told you anything, it's don't trust white people.
Oh my god, you're so fucking right.
Or the Empire.
Or both at the same time.
But yeah, it's just, like, we really get this fascinating view of Aiden's relationship with Admiral Versio, and it's... I have thoughts that we'll probably get into a little more in the next episode. I didn't think it was fleshed out in a way that fully did it justice, but...
Sorry, Chris, do you mean their relationship generally?
Yes, their relationship and its psychological effect on her.
Thank you.
But that being said, it was, like, fascinating to see that, like, it very clearly has, like, a very, like... deep effect on her, and yet, like, it has made her love for the Empire stronger in it. Like, the scene where Aiden is, like, getting Staven to believe her that she could be a dreamer because she hates her father that much, like, honestly, that was really believable to me.
I mean, I think it was believable because she was telling the truth.
Yeah, she does fucking hate her father.
Well, that part, but that, like, she could hate the Empire that much. Like, that almost made more sense to me than, like, she loves the Empire so much. Or not more sense, but it, like, definitely made as much sense.
Sure.
Kind of felt like Aiden at some point in her life was kind of on the edge of a knife, and she fell one way.
Ooh.
Other people fell another. You know where else we get that dynamic? In Lost Stars, when we read it.
Oh my god.
I know. We're ready. Our bodies are ready for that book. We're all
I'm not
so
my,
up from it.
My fucking emotions aren't ready.
Yeah, but I mean, I think I brought that up, I think, in our first episode about this, episode 20, right? Where I said, I don't understand how Aiden can be for the Empire when she has such a terrible relationship with her dad. But then we get back into, you know, the brainwashing conditioning portion of it, where those things are able to coexist because of the way that she was raised, right?
Right. I mean, I almost hate to make this comparison, but it's like kids in any totalitarian state. Like, why don't all the fucking young people in North Korea just rise up and decide, you know what, fuck this shit, because we have no food to eat.
They don't know how to do that because they've never seen anything happen that was good from anybody doing that.
I mean, has Aiden?
Exactly.
Nope. You know, Aiden's seen Alderaan.
Damn!
And the Death Star.
Yep.
All kinds of fucked up shit.
All kinds of fucked up shit. And you also have this really interesting dynamic of, like, mothers versus fathers in Star Wars. Because, obviously, we talked a lot last episode about Zihei, Aiden's mother, and Aiden versus the Admiral and Aiden. And we talked about Sidori's parents here. But, like...
It's interesting because we've talked before about how we don't see a lot of maternal relationships in Star Wars. And... that goes back to the first book we read, which is Rebel Rising by Beth Rebus. And I'm sure we're never going to stop talking about it, because at some point we're going to read Leia, Princess of Alderaan, and I just want to talk a whole lot about Leia's relationship with Brea, because we don't get a lot of that out of movies, obviously. But what I kind of wanted when I slipped this into the outline is to, even based on the limited information that we may have at this point, like, what patterns can we pull out between the two? Because they're portrayed super differently, I think.
Well, of course. I mean, her mom is an artist, right? A propaganda artist, but an artist nonetheless. And even in her message to Aiden, which I don't remember which episode we talked about. Was that last episode or the episode before?
It was last episode.
Okay. We get more affirmation in her mom's message to her about how disappointed she is than we hear from Aiden's dad the entire book.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I didn't even realize that. That's kind of ironic, being that he's the one who's always just like, you must be perfect, and you have to do these things, and you're never good enough. That's so interesting. Thank you for pointing that out.
Sure. Well, and that's, like, part of what I was going to say is, I think this kind of ties in with mothers and fathers, just because mothers and fathers raise fucked up kids every day. But
it's me! No.
Same. Do we think that Aiden taking responsibility for every bad thing that happened during the mission is, like, her hating herself because her dad kind of, like, taught her to hate everything that's not perfect? Or do you think that she's, like, truly believes that that's the right thing to do as, like, a leader? Because I got a lot of, like, a lot of self-hate vibes from her. But at the same time, like, I don't know if I was just picking up on them because I'm projecting.
I think it's both. I think probably on the surface she's like, I'm the leader of this mission and this team, and, you know, if anything goes wrong, then ultimately, like, the buck is supposed to stop here, and when it doesn't, then it's my problem. But on a deeper level, I think that's a really great point. I think, like, we know from earlier in the book that Aiden's a perfectionist because of her father's influence on her, and I think that no matter what, there's always that undercurrent in her character.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I have one question that's a little closer to the plot that I wanted to ask.
Wait.
Or that Kate wanted to ask.
Yes. It's my question!
Sorry, I remember we talked about it and I couldn't remember whose question it was.
Right. Okay, so, Chris and I were talking a little bit off-pod, so Kristen, feel free to scream at us as you always do when we talk about the book off-pod.
Talking about the book off-pod. I'm not allowed to talk about the book off-pod. I also have no one to talk about it with. It's fine. Go ahead. Carry on.
Anyway, so Chris and I had very differing opinions on the inclusion of those weird primitive robot guardians. And so basically where we landed was this question of, do they mean something in the book? Because if so, that's awesome, and then of course it should be included. But if they don't mean something, then is it kind of random? So my question is, if they mean anything, what do they mean? And I have my own answer for this, but I kind of want to hear from you guys first.
I actually really didn't like the weird guardian robots. I wasn't sure why they were included. I don't know. To me, like, that was actually one part of the book that I just actively did not enjoy.
So what we see when folks die at the hands of the dreamers, or just, you know, the dreamers have their bodies, and they go, you know, like, quote, put them in the usual place. What's their explanation that there are, like, giant rat monsters that come and eat them?
There are rats of unusual size on this planet, yes.
Okay, that's, like,
rodents of unusual size, excuse me.
Yeah, I didn't misread that, right? That's what they say?
Yeah, the crunchers.
Cool.
The crunchers.
Cool. And I don't know why they would know that when we find out at the end that it's these guardians that are taking all of the dead bodies away. But, I mean, I thought it was just, like, a symbol and a reminder that, you know, you can have this perception of really bad shit that you wouldn't want to wish on anybody, and it can be totally the opposite, and most people that we know on in the Dreamers didn't live to know that.
I think that's a really good interpretation. That's awesome.
I guess the only reason I bring that up, and I don't know if it's just like assigning that meaning to it, but we see so much of that in Star Wars that it's all about what seat you're sitting in. And I think that's especially true of the books, especially because we've been reading so many books from the point of view of the Empire lately. We've been talking about perspective and who the good guy, you know, who the protagonists are and who the antagonists are in the book. Just knowing what we know about the larger universe. But I think that's just, I think those guys are just a symbol of that, those guys being the robots. But I'm not quite sure why they were introduced in the way that they were introduced. I don't really have my brain wrapped around that piece of it, but I really just thought that it was, you know, it all has to do, with your point of view in this big galactic, you know, garbage fire.
Right. From a certain point of view, as it were.
Yeah.
Okay, so can I, like, do English nerd, like, bullshit vomiting about my theory about this?
Of course.
All right.
Please.
So, Chris and I, like I said, had the opposite reaction to the Guardians. He didn't really like them. I love them a lot. First of all, because it's really fascinating world building, just because we really haven't seen anything like this in all of Star Wars. You know, everything's very futuristic and sleek and all that, and, you know, the thought of having primitive robot guys who somehow run on brainwaves is pretty fascinating to me, and I'm probably gonna steal some part of that idea and, like, stick it in my graduate thesis or whatever, in grad school. But my thought on this was, when we're introduced to the robots, Pikao says that they were created by the original inhabitants of the planet, and there's no trace of them, and as far as he knows, they died out, a million, billion, jillion years ago, and all that's left of them is these robots. And I thought it was interesting at the end, when they're carrying away the Dreamers' bodies, that these primitive robots are seem to be more human and anthropomorphized and have more heart than actual sentient beings who, like I said, live in the future and have all this technology, but they have no soul, not any of them. And so, and I thought that was, and, like, if that's what Christy Golden meant, then I thought that was really powerful.
Well, yeah, I mean, we find out that that each crystal in the robots literally corresponds to, like, a human organ, which is super interesting. So I think that even backs up your theory, Kate.
I have a theory that's more than just I didn't enjoy the robots.
I was about to say, like, I asked you for a theory, and you're like, I hated the robots, and I'm like, okay.
No, I actually do have a theory. My theory, and if this were true and were fully fleshed out, then it would be amazing. I think my frustration is I very much, like, I don't need answers to everything because I understand the value of mystery, but I, like, if something feels random, I really don't like it, so that's part of the issue of why I didn't like them. But my theory is that they are meant to represent personifications of the Force. And I think that this is a Force-strong planet, and nobody knows it because everybody died off for so long. And they are the representation of balance in the Force, in that they don't give a fuck who you are or what you've done or what side you're on. All they are there to do is maintain the planet and bury you. And it's the Force version of ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
So are they the Bendu? Are they the ones in the middle?
Yes, they would indeed be the rocks in the river.
They scared me so much less than Bendu.
I like them. I don't care.
They're Kate's fluffy rock babies.
They are. They sounded round and cute.
They run on crystals. All I'm saying. Know what other shit runs on crystals? Like everything about the Force.
Yes,
that's a great point. Crystals. Nice. I was like, meth. No, that's not what he's talking
about. Hashtag crystals.
Anything else you want to say about the creepy robots? Or
no, I think we can move on. So one other, I'll intro it and then I'll tee it up. One other thing that we wanted to talk about with Inferno Squad, and particularly with Aiden, is there's been a significant amount of talk on Twitter lately about whether or not Aiden is the right kind of representation for women of color, with, I think, some arguing that she is evil and therefore she's bad representation. And that's not a view that I would say we agree with. And we really wanted to, A, direct you all to listen to the ContraCast from Tashi Station, which is a new podcast that three contributors to Tashi Station, at Chaos Bria, at Lane Winry, who is Brian and founder of Tashi Station, and at Admiral Jello, who are all Asian American, all like big in the Star Wars fandom, talked about what they called the Asian perspective of being a Star Wars fan and what Aiden meant to them and what about this controversy. So I don't want to rehash anything about their argument here because it's all fantastic and you should just all go listen to it. Again, it's called The ContraCast from Tashi Station. But Kate, who, for those who are maybe new or have missed it in the past, who is Chinese American, wanted to add her thoughts as well.
Right. I mean, honestly, I can probably co-sign pretty much everything that is said in the ContraCast, but the first episode where they do some introduction and they explain why Aiden is so important to the fandom. But one thing I will say is that in addition to another thing that's been tacked onto that debate about whether Aiden is quote-unquote correct representation for Asian Americans in Star Wars, is that a lot of people have been watching the trailers for Battlefront and seeing that Aiden is surrounded by white male characters, and therefore she's being tokenized, and they're kind of using that as an excuse to just kind of sweep what she, the significance of her character, to people who look like me, just under the rug, and which is something that, again, they talk about on the first episode of ContraCast, and you should absolutely listen, and I totally agree with them that that is not a valid reason for dismissing Battlefront, the video game, dismissing Inferno Squad, the book, dismissing Aiden's character. I was really excited to read this introduction into her character, and I'm really excited to play the video game and learn more about her. And I'm glad that Janina Gavankar is going to be one of the faces of Asians and like Asian appearing characters in Star Wars, because she's a fabulous person, and she's a hell of an actress, and I'm just, all in all, I'm aboard the Aiden train, and if you're not, then sucks for you that you don't derive enjoyment from Star Wars, I don't know. The other thing I wanted to say is that, so we're recording this on October 11th, and I think I mentioned last episode that we were invited by Southern Cynic to join the hashtag Representation Matters in Star Wars social media campaign. It was originally supposed to launch on October 13th, but then life got in the way for a lot of us, which is totally understandable because it's kind of that getting to be that time of year. So we bumped it to the following Friday, which is October 20th. Again, for those of you who missed our explanation of what this campaign is, it's a group of people hoping to raise awareness about representation or lack thereof in Star Wars. And so we're doing that by writing blog posts and articles, we're tweeting using hashtag representation matters in Star Wars, and we're doing some tweet threads, doing deep dives into character profiles of characters who are not, you know, white or male or human or whatever. And as part of that effort, we put together a blog post for 1138. That specifically talks about why we need more crossovers from the non-film media into the films, because what we're seeing as we read more and more and explore more and more of the non-film canon is that the largest strides in representations, especially for women of color, is happening in the novels, in the video games, obviously, in the comics. So we just kind of wanted to highlight that and talk a little bit about that and, you know, hopefully you know, be part of this movement pushing Lucasfilm to keep diversity in mind when they're casting these films and conceiving these characters and these stories and whatnot. And to that end, we got this really fabulous comment from @CelestialIntent, who is, we've mentioned her before, she's a longtime listener.
Friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod, she actually reviewed us on iTunes, hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, if you want to know how to get to be a friend of the pod.
No, she's literally a fabulous person and super nice. But she sent in this really, really smart comment that I'm just going to read in its entirety because I asked her and she said it was cool. So last episode in discussing Inferno Squad, she says, "So you compared Scylla and Jin, and as a woman of color, I really dislike Jin. It's very hard to care about someone so blasé about the Empire, and the fact that she only cared when it personally affected her screams of the white feminism we constantly see today. Even reading Rebel Rising and knowing how her character is in Rogue One, I still find it difficult to like her or care about her. That being said, maybe her character would have worked better if she had been a woman of color to begin with, which lends to the whole more women of color in Star Wars, please, and preferably characters who are not associated with the Empire / First Order, aka the villains." And that is something that I want to, like, punch myself in the face because I didn't even think of that. But that's so right, and that's such an astute observation, and, like, I don't really have anything to add to that besides that I agree. And while I really love that women of color are being represented in characters like Dr. Aphra and Rae Sloane, and they're amazing, well-rounded characters, it would be really great to see more women of color on the Rebellion side or the Resistance side. And, you know, hopefully we'll get more of that in The Last Jedi when we meet Rose and Paige Tico. But yeah, that's like probably the smartest comment we've ever gotten so far, and it's just, it's awesome. Like, thank you so much for sending that in and sharing with us and letting us share that with everybody on the pod. Seriously.
Yeah, that's great. God, I never even thought of that.
I know.
That's so real.
Don't you want to punch yourself in the face because you didn't even think of that?
Thank you for that.
White feminism strikes again.
Yeah, seriously. Like,
yeah, I was just trying to shut my stupid white feminist mouth over here the whole time everybody was talking. No, I'm not allowed to talk. But actually, we should consider doing, like, a roundup of shit that we want to revisit. So, like, that it would have been great to talk about this during the Rebel Rising wrap-up. And I'm sure we have other stuff that we would like to revisit, but anyway.
Right, I mean, we already want to revisit Thrawn, which we've said before, so.
Oh, revisit Thrawn, huh. Why, I love revisiting Thrawn.
Yeah, God, that just kind of opens up a whole can of worms, like, in a great way, a whole can of worms about how you view the characters in, particularly in Rogue One, but also in just, like, other Star Wars movies as a whole, and how they get involved, and what it means to them, and, like, you have Saw, who's, like, always the, God, now I don't even want to use the term militant, because that's such a loaded term when referring to black men, particularly in America. But, I mean, he plays this role of being the person standing for justice in a world that doesn't value him as a human being. And you have, you know, again, Cassian Andor also being very much in it from the beginning. And you have, like, all these people of color who are in this fight from the get-go because they know what it means. And you then get a lot of these white saviors who kind of come in when it starts to affect them or when their eyes are opened, which is a familiar phenomenon.
Right. I was going to say, a few episodes ago, we talked a little about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, and part of the hero's journey is that it's called the call, like the hero is called to action, they are called to be part of a bigger world than they had been part of before. And then the step after that, usually in this track, is that the hero refuses the call. And then something horrible happens that pulls them back into it anyway, and they have to get involved. And
like Aunt Beru being turned into bacon.
Yes, exactly. Which again is a trope, but we have to remember that it's a trope of Western fiction. When we talked about Joseph Campbell, I mentioned that he was racist as fuck, and his hero's journey really only works for white Westernized stories, which is the case here. And, you know, it's one of those things that we haven't really questioned, even though now that sort of theory of literature and storytelling is being critiqued, I don't necessarily know that we've gotten to the point yet where we can be like, oh, this is a trope specifically for white people, and it is problematic because. And I think that Celestial Intent's comment does a whole lot in getting us to kind of overturn that and think more about that, and I really look forward to keeping that in mind as we continue to read these books, because that's so important.
Yeah, that's totally gonna... We talk about how do these books change how we view the Star Wars universe. I think that comment for me just really, like, turned it a lot upside down.
Yeah. And basically, I feel like Celestial Intent did a mic drop on us.
I know, right?
Which is awesome. Like, please, like...
Yeah, give her a follow.
Right? Yeah, like, give her a follow. She's super smart. And, you know, if you have any comments, whether or not they are, you know, fucking blowing our minds, or you just want to tell us your trash Snoke theory that totally isn't true, like, seriously, just at us, because...
I want to know your Snoke theories.
Yeah, we're not fancy. We like to talk to you guys, and sometimes you say really smart things, and I want to lie on the floor and think about them for, like, 30 years.
Tweet at me yep. about Thrawn.
And so, speaking about Thrawn, speaking of talking to us, and pirates. Speaking of talking to us, we are at BookWorsPod on Twitter, on Instagram, on Tumblr, BookWorsPod@gmail.com, over email. And next episode, we're going to be wrapping up Battlefront 2 Inferno Squad.
And we're going to be looking at each other in the face eyes.
Yeah, we are.
In the face eyes.
In the face eyes. And also, since we're a couple episodes away and we like to give people time to buy or check out the next book from the library, next, we are going to be reading Ahsoka by E.K. Johnston.
Ahsoka!
Kate's excited.
Yeah, it's going to be another good time for Kate. Kate's been cleaning up the last few months, no question.
It's the first Star Wars book I read before I even started the pod, and that's how Chris wrangled me into this whole madness. So it's near and dear to my heart, even though a lot of people hate it. But we'll talk about that later.
We will. So anyway... until next week, we will just leave you with another call to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play. Our theme song is Whiz Bang by Poddington Bear. Our logo and artwork are by Joe Butera Design. Thank you for listening to the Book Wars Pod. For Kate and Kristen, I'm Chris, and we will talk to you next week, wrapping up Battlefront 2 Inferno Squad.
Oh, fuck, I just drank the most one.
Oh, Jesus.
Hey!